As is my wont, I always begin a class or a session or a private session even with sort of a themed quote or quotations. I have three quotes that I'd like to begin with today. The first two are from Jack Kornfield, and the last one is from the Buddha. Jack Kornfield says, "Use thoughts without being trapped by them." Use thoughts without being trapped by them. Oh my gosh, I should put that in a big sign and put it up in my bathroom wall. He also says, "We can learn to see here and now those places where we are afraid or attached or lost or deluded." Those places where we are afraid or attached or lost or deluded. And finally, from the Buddha, he asks, "Who is your enemy? Mind is your enemy. Who is your friend? Mind is your friend. Learn the ways of the mind. Tend the mind with care." So that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to tend the mind with care. So as many of you know, some of you maybe haven't been here for the last week or so, but we started 2 weeks ago, we started a fairly extensive months-long process of reviewing the four foundations of mindfulness. So this, as you all probably know, but allow me to just reinforce, this teaching of the four foundations is a teaching that the Buddha gave to his monks very early in the time after his enlightenment. Well, when things began to really build up and hundreds of people were coming to the forests and the various places where they were encamped. And the Buddha realized that he alone could not do the teaching of that all of these people were seeking from him. And so he offered this teaching to his monks, trained his monks in the four foundations of mindfulness, and asked them to go out into the crowds and teach. So this is the basic teaching that the Buddha is asking us to employ in our lives. This teaching, as you all know, is called the Satipatthana Sutra. Satipatthana Sutra. And it really is the essential teachings that the Buddha wanted us to cultivate in order to achieve ongoing mindfulness. Now, some of you know that I've just moved, and in preparing for this lesson, I realized there are several books lost from my collection. I don't think I have any boxes left over, but one of the books that I cannot find any place is a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, his interpretation of the Satipatthana, which is a book that I've used for years in my teachings. It's called Breathe, You Are Alive, and I like his explanation and I like his version of the directives, the four directives that come with each of the four foundations. So I don't have that book to hold up for you, but it's really if you haven't read the sutras themselves, that is a beautiful introduction. Breathe, You Are Alive. And in that, he gives the four directives, as the Buddha does in the sutras, of the four categories of mindfulness that we're to repeat in establishing a meditation practice. And a lot of people say that's something that you do as a beginner. I still repeat these directives. I still come back to these sayings, especially in the beginning of my practice when I'm really trying to settle down and settle into my body and into my breath. So for those of you that were here 2 weeks ago, Susan Baxter explained beautifully mindfulness of body and breath. And last week, Ali introduced us to the second foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of feelings. And tonight, I want to talk about the Buddha's teachings in the third foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of mind. But before I do that, I want to hearken back to something that both Susan and Allie did in their talks, and that is to begin with a definition of mindfulness. All four of us, Allie, April, Susan, and I have all been through Jack Kornfield and Tara Brock's teacher training program on learning to be a teacher of meditation. And one of the early sheets you other friends, colleagues of mine in that practice or in that training might remember that there was a very long, like 3-page long front and back handout early on in the course in which they gave all the various definitions of mindfulness that exist out there among the various teachers and scholars and various people who have written about, thought about, and taught mindfulness. The one that I landed on, and Allie did too, and so did Susan, I'm not sure about April, I'm sure she will say yes, but is Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness. There are lots of good definitions, but this one just seems to cover all the bases that I think are most important. And Allie talked about it last week. I'm going to talk about it again because you cannot hear this too much. So here's the definition from Jon Kabat-Zinn, wonderful scholar, medical practitioner, and teacher of meditation. He says, mindfulness is the awareness that arises. This is the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. So 5 key words there: awareness, intention, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So I just want to remind us that this is what we're doing here. This is what all the whole practice is all about, wrapped up right there in one beautiful definition. Learning to allow that awareness to rise up in us from paying attention on purpose in the present moment without any judgment, attachment, or commentary on it. So this is what we're doing. This is what these teachings are all about. And lest we get too far away from that definition, I'll keep coming back to it because this is where we're going. This is what we strive for in our practice. So today we're focusing on the mental formations of the mind and how we become identified with those mental formations. So these constructs, I often call them, or formations, as many people call them, could be a whole variety of things that rise up in consciousness. It could be thoughts, could be images, it could be whole storylines that are going on, it could be feelings, it could be emotions. When we meditate, we all know this, that this sort of whole set of data, a sort of overflowing of data, comes rolling through our minds and begins to distract us. So when we recognize our thoughts, when we recognize this torrent of thoughts of our minds, often when we're beginning, or I do it throughout my whole meditation, I'm catching myself ruminating or planning or making some sort of judgment or worrying about something, anticipating a conversation that I have to have, or justifying a point of view. That's a big one I find myself doing a lot, sort of justifying my belief about something or my understanding or my commentary that I made to somebody. Repeating thoughts. I do a lot of repetition of repeating thoughts. So these proliferations of the mind are abundant, ongoing, and seemingly endless. And the Pali word for this is papancha. And that is simply, that word simply refers to these conceptual proliferations or mental elaborations or objectifications that rise up in the mind over and over and over again. And in fact, they go on night and day, I think. I mean, I have no research to verify this. I only know that when I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm often in the middle of writing an email or constructing a line of thought that I want to. I mean, I just woke up to go to the bathroom and already I catch myself in this process. So it seems to go on 24/7 for me. So the teachers tell us that the mental formations are the driving forces in our moods, our behaviors, the tension that we hold or don't hold in our body, and ultimately in our whole life. And the troubling part about these proliferations is that we seem to be quite enthralled with them. It's like a storyline gets started in my mind as I'm meditating, and I get really caught up in it. My friend and mentor and original root yoga teacher, Beryl Bender, uses a fun metaphor for this phenomena of proliferation. She says, we hop on the bus. The bus comes by, we're sitting at the bus stop calmly trying to meditate, and here comes the bus. In her mind, it's a VW bus with a peace sign on the side of it. And she says, and we hop on the bus and off we go to the mall. All of a sudden, she doesn't say mall because Beryl doesn't go to malls, but I say mall because I can be off at the mall buying sheets or choosing towels to go in my new bathroom or whatever. And I can spend quite a few minutes on the bus thinking about what I'm going to do when I get to the mall until I say, uh-oh, you're on the bus. Come back to the breath. So I can catch myself now a lot better than I used to be able to. But still, this is a thing that happens naturally to all of us. So some of you might have heard this, and I'm sure all of my fellow colleagues from the mindfulness meditation course that we went through with Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach. Jack tells a joke, and if you've listened to Jack Kornfield, very often you hear these jokes over and over and over, and now I'm just repeating his jokes too, so his jokes are being well propagated here. But he does, this is a funny one, I think. He tells of a cartoon that he saw, I think this was in the New Yorker, depicting a car driving on a long, long western road in the desert. So a highway, a long, straight highway, and here's this car, and there's a little man driving the car, and then there's a roadside sign that reads, your own tedious thoughts for the next 2,000 or 200 miles. Your own tedious thoughts, next 200 miles. So I love that story, and don't mind that Jack tells it over and over, and I hope you don't mind that I tell it over and over too. I always give him credit. So we're all afflicted with this incredible disease of distraction and torrent of thoughts that just take over our minds more regularly than we might hope for. The thing about these meanderings, these proliferations, is that more than just being random landscape of our rambling habit patterns, habit mind patterns, these mental formations can have serious ramifications for our well-being. The Buddha says, whatever you frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of your mind. So if you are worrying a lot, mindlessly worrying over and over and over in your proliferations, that becomes a habit pattern of your own mind. So it's more than just, it's serious business that can really affect our well-being and our wellness. So think about that for a moment. How rigorously do you monitor the fluctuations of your own mind? How often do you work as you are meditating on catching yourself when you're lost in thought? And then trying, without analyzing, because we don't want to get into the habit of analyzing or certainly not judging or critiquing any of our mindless thinking, but you do want to be aware enough that you're aware of the nature of your proliferation. Some people tend to worry a lot, and so they will spend their mindless, lost in thought time worrying or anticipating problems or issues that they're going to have to face. I just ask you to think about that for a moment. How regularly are you examining the nature of your proliferations and asking yourself, is this wholesome? Is this uplifting? Is this creative? Is this inspiring? Or on the other hand, are your proliferations annoying? Sometimes they're just annoying to me. You've been thinking about that for 6 days now, Leslie. Stop it. Or maybe you're being critical of yourself or somebody else or something else, or demeaning or judgmental, which, I mean, these proliferations can take many, many forms, and I'm sure they take unique forms within each one of us. The point I'm trying to make here is, how aware are you of the nature of those proliferations? So here's what we face when we start to wake up to who we really are. We see how deeply identified we are with thought, how deeply we are lost in thought. Those are two afflictions of the human mind that our practice sets out to end, if not cut back, if not end, let's say. The other thing that's always disturbing to me is how mundane and meaningless when I catch myself lost in thought, it's always about trivial things. It seems like I never get lost in thought, thinking about philosophy or critiquing or analyzing a text that I've just read, or being creative in any way. It's usually just really boring, mundane junk. I remember taking a walk with Peter at the Shiloh Catherine retreat, and I was just appalled with myself at how boring my proliferations were. And he said, "Well, welcome to the human race, Leslie." Made me feel a little bit better that maybe we're all doing that too. So I want to read, now that we've got these two concepts out, that we identify with thought and we become lost in thought. And let me read. This was one of the books that I wanted to refer to tonight, and I didn't realize until yesterday afternoon at 4:15 that I could not find the book anywhere in this new space that I'm in. And I really wanted to refer to a couple of things that Martin Aylward says in this book. It's called Awake Where You Are, The Art of Embodied Awareness. And when I was flailing around this house trying to find this book yesterday, I realized, okay, it's lost. Maybe it got caught in the sale and it was sold. So I went on Amazon and bought it again. And thank goodness it showed up today at 1:15. So here's my, now I've sold all my books. Now I'm rebuying them. I hope I don't have to do that too many times. But I want to read you this passage. This is a wonderful book, and Martin Aylward is he's British, but he lives in France, and he has a wonderful teaching organization over there. I want to read two things tonight from him. The first one is this: much of our habitual thought loops endlessly around the same old territory. Much of our habitual thought loops endlessly around the same old territory. We repeatedly go over what has happened previously. We idly imagine what might happen next, and we vaguely narrate to ourselves what is happening now. Depressingly little of our thinking is genuinely original or inspiring, and all of that habitual mind noise is playing in our psyche like a local radio station left on in the background, often so consistently and monotonously that we barely notice it. But when we start to practice meditation, we really begin to notice, especially if you do a meditation retreat, which is like turning the volume up, increasing your sensitivity to just how much of that background noise is really going on almost all of the time in your mind. Initially, this cluttered thought just seems like a lot of hot air, endless blah, blah, mostly devoid of clarity or usefulness, boringly repetitive in its subject matter, and largely unnoticed except for in quiet moments, like when you are trying to get to sleep and your inner radio station DJ just won't shut up. So that's a beautiful description, I think, of what our minds do and how shocking that can be. So we have a tool for addressing these afflictions. By developing mindfulness of thoughts, we can see how our beliefs and fears blind us. We can see that our thoughts are always provisional and often one-sided, much more one-sided than we would like to admit. So I ask the question, is what I believe real? Is it solid? Is it certain? Mindfulness lets us see into this stream of thoughts and begin to answer this question. We see how we can become seduced by the stories that the mind spins. They pull us away from the sensory experience of the present moment, which is why the directives that the Buddha gives us in the Satipatthana Sutta always ask us to come back to the experience in the body, the experience in the breath. Our mindfulness practice allows us to look deeply at our thoughts in a kind of non-judgmental way. We learn that thoughts and stories are always present, but not always true. That's a quote from Christine Wolfe, who I took a retreat with several years ago. Christiane is her name, not Christine. Christiane Wolfe, a wonderful physician and meditation teacher, especially insightful in the teaching of meditation for pain. So that was her quotation. Our mindfulness practice allows us to look deeply at our thoughts in a kind of non-judgmental way. And we learn that thoughts and stories are always present, but not always true. We shine the light of awareness on our thoughts and rest in a spacious and compassionate heart. So just by turning that spotlight of awareness, of presence, of aliveness back into the present moment, whether that be the body, the breath, or just the state of bare awareness, that helps us begin to dissipate those thoughts. We want to, of course, acknowledge the experience of the story unfolding and the emotions and the body sensations related to the story. That is a great way to begin to dissipate these stories too, is acknowledging the emotions that rise up or the bodily sensations that occur during the thought process. We note and name the thought pattern, worry, planning. Oh, there's repeating again. You're repeating that same story, or you're repeating that same fear, fantasizing, criticizing, rehearsing, complaining. We simply want to witness those thoughts. Because as so many teachers have told us so often, you're not, the goal is not to stop thinking. The goal is to stop letting yourself be identified with the thinking. And Peter uses such a beautiful metaphor when he talks about his own thoughts, the point when he realized that they were still ongoing, but that was like they were in another room and the door was shut. So it was just a low monotone hum maybe coming from those thoughts. And that's when you really know that you've shown the light of awareness on your useless thought patterns. So we don't want to judge or critique or attack ourselves, as so many of us do. I certainly did in the early days of my practice. I was pretty impatient with my practice and what I thought I was supposed to be doing in it. But rather, we want to learn to lean back from our experience and observe it without identifying in it, or without becoming hooked into the storyline and becoming lost in thought. That is, as Beryl Bender says, hopping on the bus and hauling ass down to the mall. We don't want to do that. We want to really avoid that kind of identification, avoid getting lost, and like standing behind a downpour of a waterfall, just watching the cascade of thoughts come without judging them or criticizing yourself for having them. Observe the mind with kind awareness, we're told, without getting lost in any particular story. Shine the light of awareness on it. So one more paragraph I'd like to read from Martin Aylward. He says, this is how that habitual thought plays out. It roams around the three fields of time, repeatedly referencing and reinforcing and therefore identifying with a sense of past, present, and future. It goes back and forth, establishing networks of time and place, inner and outer, self and other, before and after, right and wrong. Oh, I love that sentence. It is so familiar, though, that we usually don't even notice it. But when we really attend, we notice the primary nodes on this constantly reinforced network. Space, time, self, world. These reference points are so familiar, so universally agreed and reinforced in all of our interactions that they seem, well, real, he says. So what would happen if we just stopped reinforcing them for a while? If we allowed the mind to give them up, to let them go and float a while, untethered by these reference points. I know, he says, it's not so easy. That's the nature of habits. We keep on doing it. So at first we wake up, we take up the practice of intentionally leaving those thoughts alone, again and again and again. Just let it go. Just let it go. Just let it go. Dropping that thought and this one, unmooring awareness from the anchor of thinking over and over and over again. Do this sincerely and steadily for a while through formal meditation practice, but also in any and every moment you remember throughout the day, and you start to notice the gaps between the thoughts. And in this space, there is possibility. In this space, there is possibility. So I want to do just a short moment, just take a moment to do a little exercise with you here. I'd like for you to think, if you haven't already, hopefully you have, I'd like to think about, for you to think very specifically about your own ways of getting hooked. Where do you become identified with a thought? Or where do you become enraptured? Do you tend to ruminate, worry, Planning's a big one for me. I can wake up in the middle of the night and be planning a to-do list or planning a talk that I'm going to give or whatever. So I'm going to be quiet for just a few seconds, not long. And I want you to think of an example, if you can, of a sort of pattern of mind proliferation that you have. And you know what? If you can't think of an example, that's a sign that you're hooked. You are hooked for sure if you can't think of an example. So you better come up with an example. I'm not going to call on you. I just want you to take a few moments to think about it. So, how to extricate yourself when you get hooked, as we all do? How do you learn to disentangle thought from reality? How do you learn to practice this mantra that we hear so often? Observe, allow, and release. Observe, allow, and release. Beryl Binder says, learn to come into relationship with what is actually going on, and can you really look at that? And can you be aware of it? And can you shine a light of awareness? Well, as Martin Elwood says, this is not easy, but the Buddha says this about meditation. Meditation is very simple, not easy, but very, very simple. So what I'd like to do is identify for us some antidotes to this. I've heard Beryl Binder speak so often. I attend her meditation classes regularly, and I've heard her say this: learn to come into relationship with what is so many times. But there's a lot left wanting in that statement. That's a kind of an order. That's a do this. And as the student, I've often said, but how? How do I do that? Well, we know from the Buddha's teachings there are several ways that we do that. One is called right effort, which I think is the same thing as another term that I've heard called the four genuine restraints. So we cultivate wholesome thoughts by dropping unwholesome thoughts. We note and we name them. And then we do what the Buddha teaches us in the sutras. We avoid generating any negative states that have not arisen. We abandon negative states that have arisen. We generate virtuous or beneficial states that have not arisen. And we do not allow any virtuous states that have arisen to deteriorate. And we develop them further. That's right effort. I love those four statements, those four directions. But again, sometimes not so easy to do. When you think about it, not to allow a virtuous state. No, I'm sorry, I'm reading the last line, the wrong line there. To generate a virtuous state that has not arisen. That's always confused me, because if it hasn't arisen, how do I know that it's there? Well, I don't want to get into a critique of the lesson that the Buddha gave for dealing with this problem of how to deal with our thoughts, but I do want to say that in the meditation, the guided part of the meditation that I took you through, I actually used with you guys a strategy that actually comes out of the Zen tradition that I have found enormously helpful in my own approach to dealing with this proliferation of thoughts. So you probably remember the question that I asked. And I want to introduce you a little bit more fully to that. And then in the Q&A, I'd love to hear some of your responses to how your body or your breath or your mind responded to that question. Stephen Batchelor is a wonderful teacher, author. He was a monk for 10 years in Korea. And he has written a book that is essentially it's essentially a retreat that he and his wife did. It's called What Is This? Ancient Questions for Modern Minds. And I don't think Steve Perlman is here with us tonight, but he's often asked me to send him some material on home retreats. This is a great book. This is just a retreat that they did. This is a transcript, really, of a retreat that they did. And it's quite wonderful. I have used this myself a number of times. So I was reminded of Stephen Batchelor and this book last January 2nd when I listened to a podcast that I listen to regularly by Ezra Klein. It's called the Ezra Klein Podcast. And the title of that podcast really caught my attention. It was, This Question Can Change Your Life. And I thought, oh boy, I love that, a podcast that's going to change my life. So Batchelor and Ezra Klein talk in this podcast for an hour and 20 minutes beautifully about this book and about this practice of asking the question, what is this? And Klein, I want to say before I talk about the Batchelor book, Klein says in his introduction to Stephen Batchelor, we are discussing the practice of remaining present in the fundamental unknowability of this life and this earth. And a lot of what he talks about in this podcast, probably the whole last half of the podcast, he's focusing on concept of uncertainty and doubt. So whoever is doing the talk on doubt when we get to the hindrances, it's not me. I wish it were. But whoever's doing it needs to listen to this podcast. I actually downloaded the transcript of the podcast because it was so good. So you can Google Ezra Klein interview of Stephen Batchelor and it will automatically come up. Is Peter giving that talk, April? Is that, oh, okay, Peter's talking on doubt. Okay, good. Maybe
I'm
I'll
not
switch.
sure. I'm not sure yet whether I'm going to
Oh,
be able
you're
to.
doubting. Okay, well, that will be worked out, to be worked out. So, anyway,
I'm just kidding.
the conversation is such a good and lively one. I highly recommend, and it's around this book, What Is This? Ancient Questions for Modern Man. And he asked this question again and again and again, what is this? And he wants us to allow the feeling of doubt to arise within us as we are sitting with and seeing what might be revealed by this question. Although we want to be careful, he's careful as he talks about this. And as I said in the meditation, this is not a question to be answered. It's sort of like a koan. What is this? But when I've just found it so helpful to me in my own practice, when I catch myself lost in thought, I will ask myself, what is this? And then I'll try not to analyze. What is it? Well, I'm thinking about this because blah, blah, blah. Try not to go into that, but just let yourself sit in that mediated space of uncertainty, of not knowing, of unknowing, and let it be. Reside with that for a little bit. As we all know, as human beings, we are so uncomfortable with doubt, with uncertainty, with paradox. And so this is part of the teaching, is to learn how to embody these contradictions of living that pervade every aspect of our life. So, as I said, Batchelor was a Zen monk from early on in his life until he was about 31, I think his early 20s, he took orders. And he sat facing a wall for 10 to 12 hours a day from the ages of 27 to 31, asking himself this question: what is this? He says that he was interested in going to a place where he could get back to the primary questions of what it means to be human. He says a good way of summing this up is the aphorism: great doubt, great awakening. Little doubt, little awakening. No doubt, no awakening. He says of the practice, the mind keeps coming up with all of these clever answers to theories, answers and theories, but at a certain point, it quietens down, quietens down. I didn't know that was a word, quieten, quieten, quietens down. That's his word. At a certain point, that quietens down. And you just come to rest in that quality of amazement and astonishment that you're here at all, and then you're in this moment. And I know we've had those moments in our meditation, hopefully frequently. These moments where we really do inhabit a kind of awareness that is present moment, that is intentional, that is non-judgmental, and we can hover there in that space of quietude. So I gave you the directions in the meditation. I want to read them again. Here are the specific directions that he offers in the podcast for starting, if you want to apply this technique as a way of addressing your proliferations. He says, what is important is to drop the question into the meditation at the point where the mind has already stabilized. And so that's why I took you through the Satipatthana directives of mindfulness of breath and body, mindfulness of feelings, and mindfulness of mind, so that we can come into the body, reside in the breath, hold our anchor, and really get to a stabilized point in our practice. I don't know about you, but that always takes me a few moments, sometimes several moments. So that might be through observing the breath or just through silent sitting practice itself, whatever your own unique technique is. So he says then, once you find yourself and you feel in your body a groundedness, this is another reason that I often start with the directives of mindfulness of body, because I want to start in my body. I want to start there to center my attention and my relaxation in the body. He says, you feel in your body a groundedness, a harmony, a balance, a calm. Then you ask yourself, what is this? What is going on? So notice that he says that you don't ask the question right when you're coming out of thinking, like trying to figure out what the thinking is. You wait till you're in a grounded spot. You wait till you're kind of into it. There's a certain amount of stabilization of the mind. And then you ask yourself, what is this? He says, allow yourself not to repeat the question, but to somehow settle into the silence in which the question is asked, and to let yourself just listen to whatever responses might come up. Now, responses that he's referring to are not necessarily thought responses. They might be feeling states, or they might be bodily sensations, or they might be a change or a shift in the breath. Just notice that the very asking of the question has brought you physically and emotionally into a new space of silence. So he says, just listen to whatever responses might come up. You listen to your body. You listen to the world. And at a certain point, he says, I think you become rather disinterested in finding an answer. Because, to be honest, there is no answer. There is just the question. Can you be with that? Can you tolerate that uncertainty, that unknowing? So, right effort, applying right effort to our proliferations, asking the question, what is this? And finally, I want to repeat the directives from the Satipatthana Sutra that we did in the meditation today, which I think are also very constructive in bringing me back out of my proliferations and into a state of bare awareness. So the directives are these four. So there are four tetrads: body and breath, feelings, mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of the body. And for each one of the tetrads, there are four directives for breathing in and breathing out. So here's the, for the third foundation of mindfulness, we breathing in, I'm aware of my mind. Breathing out, I'm aware of my mind. Breathing in, I make my mind happy. Breathing out, I make my mind happy. Somebody I know is going to have a question about that one. Breathing in, I concentrate my mind. Breathing out, I concentrate my mind. And finally, breathing in, I liberate my mind. Breathing out, I liberate my mind. Now, some people I know don't like to use mantras or sayings or directives of these sort because you don't want that. That's a form of thinking, obviously. So it's kind of tricky to do the, to use the directives, but to keep, you know, keep that steady, grounded state of stabilized awareness. So those are three antidotes that I would like to offer up. I'm sure there are many other strategies and techniques that we could think of or talk about. I've spoken for about 45 minutes now, so I'm going to stop at this point and see what you think. What is this? What's going on here? Any thoughts or reactions? First of all, to the meditation, I know I have many people that come to my meditation sessions and don't like guided meditations. And that's all, I always say, why are you coming to a class where we're doing guided meditations? So if you don't like guided meditations, that might have been distracting to you. But still, I hope it set you up for the last 25 minutes of the practice of your, you know, your own sitting within your own awareness. So questions or comments, any observations about your own experience with the meditation today, or any stories you'd like to tell about the nature of your own wild and crazy proliferations. I would love to hear them.
Leslie?
Yes.
Let me comment about that. I was listening to your really excellent presentation and contemplating this question, which I've often contemplated, what is this? I also find it useful to pose this question, what's happening here? And it's easy, what I notice is that it's easier for me to cultivate this kind of direct knowing with the body, which is what you've talked about. You know, breath awareness and body awareness. I use my whole body, kind of drop my awareness into my whole body with that kind of investigative curiosity. What's happening here? You know, there's this weird sensation in my thighs. I think it's just muscle fatigue from being at the gym today, but it's there, right? So that, from that, the more I can settle into that kind of
Yes.
curiosity, the quieter the mind gets. And when I say the quieter the mind gets, it's sort of like the volume control on the thoughts starts to fade.
Yes.
It's quieter and quieter. That's what I mean about being in the other room. And this morning, my meditation, it seemed more that, when there was an awareness, a knowing of thoughts, that the thoughts, the whole process of thinking seems so ephemeral, so like mist, or dye in water or something. Very, very, it's really interesting. It was a different understanding. So that is my response to your teaching, in terms of
Thank you.
my direct experience while we were sitting here.
See, I just love that. Thank you. Thank you so much, Peter, because I don't know about you guys, but I learned so much from hearing things just like what Peter said about his own experience. That helps me understand my own experience. And I think, as you know, earlier in the year, maybe it was last year, I don't remember when, but for a while there, I was doing quite a lot of talks on investigation. So the teachings tell us, and Stephen Batchelor says this too, actually it's his wife that says this in the book, that we're working on mindfulness and investigation of mindfulness. So what Peter has just demonstrated for us is the investigation part that can go on after the meditation, in which you come to understand some aspect of the experience and hopefully can replicate that or continue with that to be of benefit and wholesome, as the Buddha would say. So I really encourage us to share these things with each other. And if anybody else has an experience of their lost in thought experiences, we would love to hear them.
I don't know if you can hear me, Leslie.
Yes, I can.
Wonderful, wonderful presentation. I feel like I've been around the world in a variety of ways and roads, just listening to your various the points you were making. And when you said, what are your thoughts? And I was thinking about, first of all, feelings. There's a lot of different feelings or emotions and things like that that come up. But usually the body is really a big deal for me because, like Peter said, I notice aches or sensations, I should say, from maybe something in my body where the muscles have been. And then I start asking, what is this too? Because is it anything to worry about? Or is it, is it going to go away like it came? How do I, and what do I do if I do anything? So that's a lot of my papancha.
Yum.
And I'm just going to say, along with the intrusions that come into my environment at home, I have found that there are a lot of attempts to, so much information is out there about me because of breaches and the gathering of that and the demographic that I'm in, that I get calls and they're bogus calls, phone calls, but I'm expecting perhaps an important call. So, I can't just turn everything off. So managing is a big part of my experience, all of the, it's like I want to say, I'm thinking about the how you feed a plant and the roots go into the soil, and sometimes the things, the nutrients and all of that, they travel through the entire plant. And sometimes for me, it's like all of that. The environment is the surrounding, the air, the sun, the soil. For me, everything that is in my environment. If I go outside, the sun will influence my feelings. So it's hard to say it's either this or that. It's a great big conglomeration.
Yes, absolutely. It's not like we're all sort of monotone in the form of thought that we get lost in, but you know, it varies, I'm sure, for all of us from day to day. And the point of this whole third foundation is to help us just become aware of that, you know. So just be aware of it. You're doing the work, and that's all you can do, is do the work.
I think sorry for jumping in.
Please.
I think at the very beginning of the talk, you talked about the gap and what happens in the gap.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me through your whole talk. Mm. And I kept referring back to, as you were mentioning things, going, that happens in my gap. Mm. Or what's happening in my gap? Is this in my gap? And I was having those questions go on as you were talking, thinking about how important the gap is.
Oh, yes. Good.
And that the gap really is where it all happens.
Yeah. That's good, Susan. I agree.
Mind the gap.
Mind the gap, yeah.
Yeah, it's minding the gap and recognizing that if we're not quiet enough to recognize the gap, we are missing so very much. So thank you for this.
You see, that's just helps. That's helpful to hear how somebody else's mind, how you're working with your own mind, which is what we're thinking, is what we're trying to do. Thank you, Jim. I'm grateful. I'm grateful for you too.
Yeah, I mentioned mind the gap because that's something, if you ride the metro in London, when you get on it's a subway.
Oh, that's right.
There's a recording that says, mind the gap.
Mind the gap.
You know, if you don't mind the gap, there's some serious trouble going to happen there.
Yes. That's good. So true.
John, I have a question.
Yeah, John, you have a question?
Not a question, just a comment on that. It's interesting how you can listen to someone speak and their thoughts, and you can stay in your breath in your own gap, you might say, and just enjoy it. You don't have to respond. And that's a very interesting to me, because that's what meditation gives you, is the ability to watch. Other than thinking, at the same time, you may have a thought, you may not have a thought, but you're able to observe both, and I think that is what gives you more sanity. Just at least it does me, and that's kind of what... it's interesting how different exercises that we do in listening trigger. So, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Satish has a comment.
Well, listen, I don't ask what is this, because I think that question cannot be answered. And you already said that you're not looking for an answer. But the question for me is, who am I? That's the question for me. But having said that, I was curious, what was Leslie's experience when she asked that question? What is this?
Did you hear that, Leslie?
No, I did not. I
So
heard it was.
question that Satish posed is what's your experience of applying that? What is this to your own
Well,
subjective experience?
yeah, it for some reason, and maybe it's because I've done it for a while now, but it does stop the flow of rumination for me. It's like a trigger that lets me know you have some control. You're not out of control here. Your mind does not have to be the bully that it often appears to be. And so for me, it is that moment. What is this? I don't try to answer that question. I just try to hold the space or the gap, hold the space of that unknowing. I am driven by a desire to know and control. I mean, I know this about myself after 79 years of living. And I've been working on this for a long time with a lot of different people and modalities. But meditation has been the one that has served me highest and best in just having those sometimes just momentary gaps, momentary kind of like floating in air where you're not doing anything, you're not thinking anything, you're not worried about anything. And as we all know, and as I start, I didn't really get back to talking about the beginning quotations, but we know that this is part of the process of being a meditator, that you have to do that kind of close observation and investigation at some point in your day, maybe not in the meditation itself, but at some point, because that carries over into the next sit, then that capacity that you have for knowing that you're going to get lost in thought and it's going to be annoying to you, but you're going to stop it. And maybe if I am on this earth a few more years, I'll get those gaps will get bigger and bigger and bigger. I hope that's helpful, Satish.
Not, but anyway, the question is, if Leslie is getting annoyed, is she being judgmental?
Course.
Ask her.
If you
What did he
get annoyed,
say?
Leslie, if you're getting annoyed, are you being judgmental?
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
think what Leslie's saying, Satish, is that being this kind of what is this attitude, it's not even really a question, it's an attitude, a curiosity. What it does is it reveals how judgmentalism emerges into awareness. You know, it's one of the things, I very much support what Jon Kabat-Zinn, how he defines mindfulness. But there's something to add on at the end. It says, without judgment. Mindfulness, in a sense, is without judgment. But right after that, or along with that, has to come right effort, which
Yes.
is about judgment and making a judgment to support that which is wholesome and to starve that which is unwholesome. So that's important.
Well, it doesn't have to be judgmental. You just notice him. Anyway, it's okay.
No, judgmentalism starts to it reinforces the subject-object duality. It
Yes.
reinforces there's a judge and there's that's what's being judged. And that's what we're trying to deconstruct, is that process. And what allows that to happen is that perspective of what is this that sees it as something the mind fabricates that may or may not be useful, in this case by being judgmental, which there's it, being judgmental is different than being discerning. Being
Discerning,
discerning
yes,
means that you
that's,
can tell the difference.
yeah.
Judgmental means you're passing judgment And it's important to recognize that. But we're getting to the end of our time tonight.
Peter, one more thing I just want to point out for people who are on Zoom, my trusty assistants here, April and Susan, both gave links for the podcast and for the transcript. Thank you, Susan and April. So they're in the chat. Check it out. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Edwin.
All right, so it's our custom at the end of each meeting to sit together silently. I will say that the next meeting, next Wednesday night, will be an open Dharma questions meeting. I will be available to respond to any questions you have about Buddhist doctrine or your meditation practice experience. So let's sit together in silence briefly. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy. So next time we have a chance to chat.